What is the science of story? How do we tell stories that work, that are effective about the human and human relationship with the natural world? It gets into rhetoric, it gets into journalism, but also it gets into personal stories and memoir style conversations about what it means to be human in this day and age.
This is A New Angle, and I'm your host, Justin Angle, marketing professor at the University of Montana. This podcast is my chance to speak with cool people doing awesome things in and around the great state of Montana. Thanks for tuning in this week. Before we get into today's episode, I wanted to make a special announcement about our editor and producer, executive producer, Stefan Borsum. Stefan is a graduate of our business program here at the University of Montana, 2017 graduate. And I asked him if he would be interested in launching this podcast with me. And he jumped on the opportunity, and it's just been doing awesome work. And we sort of started this thing flying by the seat of our pants with a shoestring budget. It's not even a budget. So, we Stefan came in at a critical time and made things happen. And it was with kind of a heavy heart, but excitement for him, that we sort of bid him farewell from the producer role. He's going to be moving into some more marketing, audience development, going to be sort of pulling the lens out and looking at some big picture stuff. So I can't thank Stefan enough for his contributions to this endeavor, and I look forward to working with him in the future. Thank you, Stefan. Okay, today's guest, Nick Triolo. Nick is, the only way I can describe Nick is he is a true Renaissance man. I met Nick through the running community when we both lived in the Pacific Northwest and shared the trail over many an ultra marathon, and got to know him a little bit more professionally through some of his film work and his environmental advocacy work. And then he recently was a student in the Environmental Studies graduate program here at the University of Montana. And his goal in that program was to study the tools of narrative to make a difference in the environmental space. He is an advocate, he's an activist, he is a writer, he's a communicator, he's a leader, he's a mountain athlete, he's a guide. He basically is exploring all the different possible tools he has at his disposal with the many gifts he has to get people engaged and concerned and active in the environment and trying to make the world around us a better place. Nick's an inspiring guy. We had the opportunity to sit down. It was one of those rare Montana summer experiences where, I was coming into town and he was leaving town an hour later, and the planets aligned well enough for us to sit down and record the pod. I thank him for his generosity. Super engaging guy. And let's turn it over to Nick Triolo. Okay, so we're here today with Nick Triolo. Nick, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
So this is, I will say, like a strange overlapping of time windows. I'm straight in from Big Sky, and you are about to leave for Portland. And we had about an hour of overlap here in Missoula after five sort of failed years of both living here and failing to get together for much.
It's true.
Yeah. So thanks for making it happen.
Yeah. Thanks for inviting me.
I guess these microphones have a tendency to actually create a good excuse for people to get together.
I'm happy that you have them. Thank you.
Yeah. So Nick, you are a 2016, I guess, graduate of our Master's in Environmental Studies program. Is that correct?
True.
Okay.
Yep.
And I don't even know how to introduce you. I mean, you are a writer, you're a mountain runner, a guide, an activist, a filmmaker, just a guy that kind of exudes creativity and hustle on so many dimensions. How would you what would you be your elevator pitch if somebody said, "Hey, Nick, what do you do?"
It's a really good question. I think you hit it on the nose. At this point in my life, I feel like I'm exploring a few different hats at the moment. But I came to Missoula in 2013 with an interest in learning how to tell better stories.
Uh-huh.
So it's a Master's of Science in Environmental Studies here at the U, and there's a wing, like a creative nonfiction focus.
Okay.
And so what is the science of story? How do we tell stories that work, that are effective about the human and human relationship with the natural world?
Yeah,
it gets into rhetoric, it gets into journalism, but also it gets into personal stories and memoir style conversations about what it means to be human in this day and age. I was interested in that. I have been for a long time, And that totally kind of dovetailed with a kind of heightened sense of advocacy work and activist work in the Pacific Northwest. And it also kind of somehow finagled its way into like endurance activities and how I know you through the long distance running community.
Right.
And what that those kind of intersecting circles of influence have done to kind of orchestrate this new kind of identity of really interested in being a student of storycraft, how to hack a new story about our relationship with the natural world, and that is through deep immersion in wild space, that is through deep community efforts, that is through learning how to mobilize people and mobilize myself to take action about things I care about.
I want to get into, you know, the how, the tools that you've acquired along the way and maybe that this program helped you build and what you're planning to do with those. But before that, I'd like to just kind of get into, you know, by way of some bio, what sort of brought you to this position where you felt like my life's work is to tell important stories and to get people engaged on, you know, issues about the natural world?
Yeah. I guess it comes from deep interest in story because of being affected by stories, being the product of someone who is a book nerd growing up, who spent hours and hours in my treehouse escaping, you know, the world to immerse myself in new worlds in books, and realizing the power, like the deep kind of intuitive power of what a story can do to change the way you see the world.
What were some of the first that really struck you?
Gosh, you know, one of the first books that totally woke me up to big literature was Crime and Punishment. Mm-hmm. That was the book that maybe as like a 15-year-old, a 14-year-old, that was, it just rocked me, like completely took me for a spin.
Uh-huh.
Later books, I mean, I could get into books forever on this podcast,
we could do a whole podcast about that.
Totally, but I think that reading is one of the most important ways to write better.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of one of the biggest recommendations that all my mentors have said.
You
know, to be able to play, you know, jazz, to be a jazz drummer, you got to listen to a lot of jazz.
Mm-hmm.
And to be a writer in particular genres, you got to read the canon.
So
I think I'm still very much a student. I wasn't an English major in undergraduate. I wasn't like a, you know, naturally gifted writer. I'm still totally working. I'm a workhorse to figure out how to make this happen.
Sure.
And so I'm vehemently, like, I'm studying voraciously about how to write better, how to communicate better. Gary Snyder, Bill Plotkin, Naomi Klein, Wallace Stegner. The list goes on.
Yeah. So you're sort of developing this. Yeah, this passion for storytelling, but also, hey, this natural world is under great stress from all these different dimensions. You're trying to marry these two. At what point did you really develop some heightened awareness of the environmental world around you and your role in helping protect it and raise awareness for that importance?
Yeah, I think that came from spending a big chunk of time in the Pacific Northwest in Portland in my early 20s. That's also kind of the time that trail running came into my life as a really kind of obsession of mine, and getting into these public lands every single day.
Yeah.
Almost like to a fault. It was like a very kind of disproportionate amount of my time was spent in the woods practicing this.
And that's kind of the nature of the long distance running space.
Yeah.
You just spend absurd amounts of time by yourself on the trails.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. But it does teach you this importance of, one, just the perspective of, wow, how vast these open spaces are. And it does sort of, it kind of creates this, it's like a juxtaposition between our insignificance in the face of all this natural beauty and scale and scope, but also, you know, when you come back out of the woods and you see the impact humans have had on the natural world, or impact, I don't know if that's the right word, but how these two things interface is, I think, a really powerful experience associated with that trail running.
Totally, Justin. And I think I had a conversation recently with somebody about public lands as training ground, which is kind of interesting and a new way of looking at our public lands, our federally designated wild spaces and national forests, certain more so, I guess, wilderness areas. But as both a mirror to our own self-willed capacities to to grow and reciprocate what we have, the gifts that we have, and to give back to the place, and also a training ground to basically train to live as a steward for these places. And again, like, you know, I have to be honest and say that, you know, trail running, long distance running was a conduit to access these places, and which have already kind of been designated, I realize. And a lot of it was, you know, you're in your head about your own life and your own selfish kind of activities. And but in the end, you know, you're spending 20 hours a week passing through these places, these training grounds, these mirrors to our own potentials, I think. And it's up to us to be able to figure out the quality of that relationship, that experience. And some days the quality is very harmonious with that place. And some days they're totally in my own head about job and girlfriend and debt and, you know, all these things that we kind of stress about. But they're patiently waiting for us there. And again, I realize that, you know, a lot of work has been put into designating these places and protecting these places. And so I think at some point there was a moment and maybe like several years ago living in Portland where I realized that that's a dynamic narrative. That's a dynamic process. That is not, you know, wild spaces aren't permanently permanently designated. They're subject to change.
Sure.
And based
on,
as
is everything.
As is everything. And something kind of T-boned me in that time. I think Occupy Wall Street was another big kind of stimulator for me. I totally was not an activist in high school, was not, you know, picketing anything, was pretty like run like middle way approach, politically pretty moderate. Something about Occupy like woke me up at a time where long distance running was getting me in these places.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Then also there was this kind of banking greed kind of sensibility coming from Wall Street. And I just, I mean, Portland was on fire. Portland was the biggest
big part of the culture there.
Yeah. It was a big part of the culture. I think it was the biggest camp outside of New York, about Manhattan. And so I just kind of got swept up in this whole scene and I like flung out of there a little bit like traumatized, but also a lot of it inspired.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what to do with that. And that's what brought me to, I left Portland, I left my job, and I really started asking myself, what is it that I love doing, and how does that relate to an honest human relationship with the world, and my honest relationship with the world.
Yeah, and so fast forward a little bit, you know, one of my sort of first, you know, sort of knew each other from the running scene. We'd meet each other at races, and briefly, yeah, just sort of as one passes the other, like, hey, we know, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, when you sort of really got on my radar screen for the work you do is with this film about the gold mine in Mexico you produced. And at the time, trail running was ascendant as far as the public awareness of these people running these ultra distances, and brands were starting to promote themselves as far as attaching themselves to athletes and telling stories about the various things they were doing. And your film was different in the sense that it, in my view, was kind of the first to really marry the running activity with some sort of an activism goal, and to have a real genuine sort of symbiosis between the method, you know, the message and the method. So, and I'm not trying to criticize other films, but a lot of films were like, hey, I'm going to run across Wyoming to raise awareness for, you know, some ailment, right? Which is great. I mean, go run, do that thing you want to do, raise awareness, raise some money, whatever. But there's sort of like a thinness to that, if that makes sense.
Totally.
Where your film came out, it was like, okay, this activity is integral to the issue at hand. So I'm not really painting the picture well enough, but so what was the issue, and how did you decide on a running film to kind of tell that story?
Yeah. Thanks a lot for that. I, backing up a few months before, that happened in the spring of 2013, to give some context. But prior to that, I had just run Western States, the 2012, which Western States, for those that don't know, are it's kind of the biggest 100-mile foot race in the world.
Mm-hmm.
It's
premier 100-mile race in California, like Toyota to Auburn, California.
Exactly. Somehow finagled my way, got a golden ticket, had a really good race, but kind of felt like something had ended in some ways. Not that running had ended for me, but some shift when I hit that finish line, you know, 18 hours in, I was kind of spent physically for sure, but also kind of psycho spiritually in some ways, that something had shifted in my gravitational center after that race. And I had to really ask myself, I think it was probably overtraining, all these things kind of wrapped up in it. But something was ending, and with endings come beginnings. And I think that something's shifted where I had to ask myself what this practice was leading me towards.
Well, as you said, like 20 hours a day, a week, that's your huge, it's a huge allotment of physical and mental and just career or resources toward this one end.
Yes.
So I just sort of setting the stage here, like to complete Western States takes a huge commitment on so many dimensions of your life. So I can
Absolutely.
See how this reaching the finish line is symbolic and maybe inspirational in a lot of different dimensions.
Yeah. I mean, you couldn't have said it better. I think that it really asked, I had to ask myself what my priorities were.
Right.
And I have X amount of time in my life. I have, you know, am I being overly selfish here? Are my relationships being served? Is the bigger work that I need to do in the world, is that being addressed? A lot of the answers for me at that point were no. Like
yeah.
they were kind
yeah,
of
yeah.
being set aside.
Something's out of whack.
Yeah. Spend 3 hours a day doing this thing and at the expense of a lot of other more professional goals and kind of ambitions. So anyway, not to get too far into that, fast forward, I end up moving to Mexico, to
yeah.
Baja, to a small town called Todos Santos, where I had visited before in the past and had some relationship with some folks there and was house-sitting. And started kind of meeting folks. Actually, it kind of started where I street art. I was walking kind of down these kind of alleyways and started seeing all this amazing kind of street art about an open-pit gold mine up in the mountains of southern Baja in
yep.
the Sierra de Laguna Mountains. And I started kind of asking around, who's behind this? Is this a problem? Is this an actual threat or is this old? Realized that, in fact, it was an ongoing struggle. A Canadian-led kind of gold mine in the a Canadian-led gold mining company were trying to get permits to open pit mine in these mountains.
Okay.
The biggest problem about that is water, essentially. There's like very little water in the Baja Peninsula.
Right, mining is hugely water intensive.
This particular mining process is particularly water intensive.
Yeah.
It just didn't make sense on an ecological and ecologically and also kind of socially. It felt off, and it felt like the peninsula was mobilized to check this
sure.
and to run environmental, you know, some sort of kind of check on giving these permits. But they were seemingly like going ahead pretty quickly. There had been a bunch of efforts to stop it there to varying degrees of success. I start kind of sitting in on meetings in this small town of environmentalists, lawyers, business owners, all Mexican, with the exception of a few, mainly, I mean, 100% Mexican-driven led. And they were looking for a new campaign.
Uh-huh.
And
Something fresh.
And I had an idea that how about we run across the peninsula in a day? How about we start in the Sea of Cortez on the east side of the peninsula? It's, I think, like the fifth largest peninsula in the world. It's massive. And we run, bike, walk, crawl, whatever it took, human powered.
Get over the top
from east to west, 70 miles from La Ribera to Todos Santos. And we end in the plaza of this epic pueblo for like an evening of talks and, you know, and seminars and traditional dance.
Sure. And just to be clear, like, we're not talking about like a flat run across
yeah.
a beach.
Yeah.
I mean, this is rugged, remote country.
Totally. Never,
yeah.
like I had run up the highest mountain a few times to check out the route, but essentially had no idea what I was getting myself into. And yes, there was a 7,000 foot mountain range from sea level, so a 7,000 vertical foot wall from the start.
Sure.
And very few people had run it before. I had to check it out in sections. I would camp out at ranch families. Ranch families would put me up deep in the mountains, and I would kind of sleep on cots outside and wake up in the morning. They'd like show me the way. And, you know, it was like this kind of 2-month process of putting together the route. And essentially exactly what you said, the route was very intentional in that it cut right into the proposed mining site.
Sure.
So essentially we were organizing a media strategy to kind of experientially get in there and see what, like, the heartbeat of that place.
And it wasn't just you. Like, you were bringing, like, once the route was set, yeah. you're bringing in this whole tribe of really interesting characters.
Totally.
Some of which had never even contemplated moving on any, you know, sort of self-propelled method that far, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I showed up in the morning, had no idea if anybody was going to be there.
right.
No idea. And
come one, come all.
Yeah, and there was probably maybe a couple dozen people, many of which were just doing the first section, like yeah. 20 miles, and the kind of the approach from the east side. But then a few guys were like, "No, we're doing the whole thing." You know,
they're in.
I think they were both from La Paz. One guy was like a car dealership, you know, car dealer or something. The other was, you know, who knows what he did, but he had just done the Iron Man. He's like this short little kind of stout guy.
Uh-huh.
And they were just ready. They had like a, you know, like a plastic, they had like a water bottle in their hands, and they
sure.
had no other like gels, or they didn't have any gear. It was just, let's do this.
We're in.
3 a.m, gun goes off, and we start going west, and, you know, 18 hours later, we make it over, up and over, and we jump in the Pacific Ocean.
Right. So let's fast forward from that a little bit to, okay, so, and I'm going to make some assumptions here, but I'm assuming you're tabbing in at this point, like, okay. You know, I can sort of do this thing, this storytelling thing, and apply it to areas where I have passion. And then you move to get some formal training here at the University of Montana. So what was it about this? I mean, you sort of laid out why you decided to come here, but let's yep. talk about the craft of narrative and storytelling and what makes for a good story and what makes for ineffective story. And this trade-off between simplicity and complexity. I'm so fascinated by this, not only in terms of the work you do, but in how brands operate and how
right.
political campaigns operate and how leaders operate within an organization. So I'll just sort of throw that out there. It's like, you came to this place to get some formal training. What did you learn that's worked for you, and how has that jived with your personal journey as well?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, one thing, stepping back a few years, my work in Portland was working with the marketing and communications
yeah.
at a nonprofit doing intercultural education. So I think that also, I mean, it's one of those adages of like, you got to fold everything into your path, you know, that kind of cliche, but that's totally true. I mean, I was kind of painstakingly doing this kind of marketing work that I loved in so many ways because of what you just said, the narrative, the messaging, the kind of conventions of persuasion, certainly when it relates to something that you love and that you really wish that students would consider, in this particular example, studying abroad.
Sure.
I woke up every day and went to work and felt truly that the work I was doing was helpful and suggesting this opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, that really kind of set a stage for the then thinking about how narrative, as it relates to environmental protection and as it relates to the human relationship with the natural world, how those tools that I learned in kind of the marketing communications world could be then applied to a more creative, personalized story grid, story craft.
Right.
And so I think that then kind of T-boned me as I then, you know, said yes to a graduate program at the University of Montana, got a gig teaching English here, and through that process, was thrown in the hot seat, was thrown mm-hmm. in workshops.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Justin, man, I mean, I've never been like, to be honest, just to be transparent, I've never like gone to much counseling in my life, but the closest thing that I've gotten to a psychotherapy session have been in workshops, graduate level writing workshops.
Sure.
Because you bring in, you know, you say you write a 5,000 word essay about something, say about this crossing. And I, you know, you bring it out, you print it 15 copies, everyone gets copies, they read it ahead of time, you come in and you just get reamed. You know,
oh, yeah.
you get. And I did, and I'll look back at stuff that I wrote in 2013. It's just cringeworthy, but that's where the growth happened. That's
Absolutely.
Where the growth happened. You sit there and you take not only the line by line edits on kind of just faults of syntax, but also the unconscious, the subconscious, the undercurrent of the story. What is it that like you're telling up here on the top, and then what is it that you're really communicating down under? And those levels of play on story just like woke me up and it was fascinating to me. And I also realized how much work I had left to do, and still to this day, like complete student.
Right, but then as a reader yourself, or as a viewer of content or whatever, you're also, you're not only applying these new tools to your own creative narrative, but you're also sort of able to critique and see those layers in other outlets as well.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, one thing, this is probably fairly obvious, but maybe not. A lot of the work on ecology and environmental humanities has traditionally kind of omitted the human.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, nature writing has been this kind of like meditation on things out there at the and kind of absent human experience. And yet, I mean, some of my biggest mentors, you know, William DeBoise, who I just spent a week with on the Salmon River with this amazing outfitter called the Free Flow Institute, of which I'm on the board and a co-facilitator. He keeps saying, I mean, he's a Pulitzer Prize finalist writer. He's like, humans are so integral in the conversation about the natural world and how we experience it. And to, you know, we need, for writing, for the best kind of masterpieces of craft are like, the characters are central. You know, the tension that we carry with us, the tension that we, you know, Crime and Punishment, there would be no novel without like the characters in that book.
Right.
You have to have compelling characters that really convey the tension of how we as humans relate to our niche in the world. And so when I approached this graduate degree, you know, environmental humanities, nature writing, you know, you so often think of this just kind of essays on the wild forests. And really, I mean, what I've taken away is that is so important, that observation, that attunement, that attention is central. But also, you know, we can't forget that humans are part of that conversation. We are central. We're not central to that conversation, but we are an integral part. And to include the human kind of eyeballs in our stories are important,
right?
Too. I think that rhetorically, and as someone who likes to read stories, I also like the personal dimension's really important to me. And so, in my work, I've kept myself in a lot of the essays. Not for selfish ends, but thinking that that's a rhetorical move, that is being honest with my readers and myself, that I'm here, I don't have the answers, I'm totally like going through this experience with you.
I think that aligns a little bit with kind of some debate in journalism about like, is it possible to have objectivity,
right?
Or is objectivity even a goal that to which one should aspire? Mm-hmm. You know, this notion of the view from nowhere. Whereas others would say, no, you have to put yourself in the story, be transparent with your perspectives, biases, whatever you want to call them, and your background and how that relates. I mean, I think that there's a truth to that way of storytelling that it just seems more genuine.
Yeah, and I think you're totally right. And there's effective ways of doing that, and you know, there's heavy-handed ways of doing that.
Yeah,
and that's
absolutely
totally the art and science of what I'm so compelled and interested to do. I mean, for example, I was in Butte yesterday, and a couple years ago, I wrote a story. I walked around the whole perimeter of the Berkeley Pit,
mm-hmm.
As a kind of a.
How long did that take?
It took forever. It was like I think it was like a 15-hour walk. It was a 20-mile walk, but there's trespassing. It was sketchy, but it was an experience that turned into a story. That is part of the manuscript that I'm working on, a bigger book manuscript. And I joined this kind of old-timey geohydrologist from Butte who had spent his whole life there, had studied the kind of the water dynamics there, had worked with ARCO, but had also worked with like community organizers. He had this incredible kind of sacred balance of understanding place. And he was right in the kind of crosshairs of industry meets conservation meets all these things. And he was kind of seemingly respected by all kind of fronts. And it's a long story, but we became friends through, I was working at the University of Montana and met him through a kind of a field trip that I was organizing. And he mentioned wanting to walk around the perimeter of the Berkeley Pit.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, I've been living here forever. I want to someday, no one's ever done it. I'm getting pretty old. I'm considering doing this. And at the time I was working on a manuscript that involves, a really clunky word, circumambulation, so circuitous walking around sacred sites.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So a lot of my research.
So this is right in your wheelhouse.
Totally, but totally, like, not, too, in that all the examples up until that moment were, you know, these very kind of low-hanging fruit, you know, locations like Mount Kailash in Tibet, where people walk a 50K around this beautiful mountain.
Maybe the opposite of a sacred site.
Yeah.
Less important.
Totally. It's an inverted hole in the earth, kind of a mountain inverted. Sacred maybe to some, sacred to, you know, the copper barons, or sacred to the folks that live there and, you know, fed their families every day.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
So the whole piece, so I joined him. So I said, hey, Joe, I'm going to meet you and we're going to do this. And I met him at 4 a.m. and we like drank some coffee together and we walked for the next 15 hours around this thing. And we crawled, you know, jumped fences and like hid behind trees to evade, you know, security guards, and made it around the tailing ponds and everything, and up and over the Continental Divide, and had to walk some freeway miles. And we got to the end, and, you know, one thing, the story of talking about the Berkeley Pit and that kind of that gash in the earth that will be here in perpetuity for us was best told through the eyes of this man, of Joe. But I wanted to be there with him. It wasn't my story to tell of his. I mean, I told it, but I was also, I wanted to respect his story enough to join him.
Yeah, and participate.
Right. And so it's my take that stories are impactful when they are shared and when they're kind of experienced, that kind of gonzo journalism, but maybe kind of transposed upon a more environmental lens. And that was, I mean, I was teared up after that. I mean, that was an incredible experience.
Sure.
And I mean, even more incredible was that he brought a couple jars with him, and he, one of his like life tasks was to go up to the north end of the pit where water was kind of shedding off the divide, and capture native water, like water that had been pure before it hit the pit. The pit.
Yeah.
And jar it up, bring it back to the Upper Bow Creek,
put it back into the water system.
Yeah. Wow. So I like joined him for this work that he wanted to do. Mm-hmm. It was this, and he's a science, hyper-rational minded folk, you know, guy, but also just had this beautiful kind of artistic way about him that was his pilgrimage.
Yeah.
And I just like was witness to that.
Oh man.
It was intense.
So one of the things I think about, Nick, with your work is this trade-off between, you know, a simple story and a complex story. Like a simple, if you think about, you know, from a branding perspective or, you know, leadership messaging or organizational communications, like, hey, clear, simple, consistent message has to be digestible. Yet with something like, you know, environmental advocacy, climate change, public lands, etc., and there's so much richness and complexity to it. How do you view that trade-off? And then two, your stories by nature, at least the stories of yours that I've consumed, are complex, and that's a beauty to them. But how do you get people in the door to kind of give you enough of their own bandwidth to pay attention?
I think that's a big question.
That's a million dollar question.
Yeah, that's a million dollar question. Okay. And I think what I've come to the conclusion of is that, you know, I think that there's a tendency to either or kind of that answer.
Okay.
Either you know, to really fully address climate change and look it in the eyes, you go to personal stories. That's like a huge, you know, a lot of surveys say like the best way to change behavior or like conceptions about climate change is to make it personal, to make it local, to localize the people living on the train lines.
Yep.
There's kind of health, kind of adverse health effects to coal dust, for example, mm-hmm. here in Missoula, for example. Or then there's like the big kind of big science of like, those stories don't mean anything. That's too small. We need to go big, big picture. But as we were speaking earlier, you know, evolutionarily, our kind of monkey minds have a really hard time being able to digest the scale of what's upon us right now, and then to be able to catalyze that or alchemize that into action.
Right.
So often we take that in through our esophagus and we spit it out in despair, and we spit it out into like, it's too big. I can't touch it. Why bother? Why bother? And I think that that's fair. And that's actually probably maybe true. I don't want to be like hopeless, but maybe it is too big. But that's not to say that it's not worth showing up every day to talk about kind of solutions.
Sure.
And to talk about how in this moment of climate, kind of runaway climate catastrophe, can we still maintain how we can still elevate and level up to being fully human.
Mm-hmm.
What is maybe I'll ask this question, and maybe I'm not answering this totally straight on, but what is it that our particular climate moment right now is inviting us into? That's what I ask myself a lot. And I ask, when I was thinking about our conversation this morning, I was thinking about what is the climate, how is that galvanizing us to take action in some way? What is it asking of us? What is the 400 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere suggesting we respond with? And I think it's almost one of the best opportunities we have ever yet to put together some semblance of a unified planetary response that to something that is a challenge to us. Yeah. And to elevate as a community, both as a planetary community and very much kind of localized and in place.
Yeah, it would seem like at all levels of human existence, the individual, the community, collective, all the way up to sort of, you know, the way governments organize on a global perspective or don't organize, whatever the case may be, like climate change is an issue that challenges us in a way to come up with solutions that are going to take the best that humans can come up with.
Sure.
At least I think so.
Sure. And I mean, as we were saying earlier, you know, it's almost counterintuitive to think that solution might just be right here in Missoula,
right,
or right here in my kitchen, or right here in my dietary choices, or right here in my bicycle over my car, or right here, you know. And it's so easy to wash those away as being not big enough, because mm-hmm. the problem is planetary. So how can the solution be local?
Yeah.
And that's the work that we're in. I mean, Wes Jackson, dry land farmer, incredible kind of writer, philosopher, said that, you know, we're in desperate need of a cultural homecoming, to come home. And I keep on seeing this in all these books I'm reading, is that the task now is to come home. And again, to come home to our bioregions, to come home to learn the plants and animals that we live next to. Maybe to come home and listen a little better to our community, both human and more than human. This is the task that I fail at often.
Yeah.
And I personally am in a kind of a wrestling match with finding that home and coming home.
Mm-hmm.
But I do, there is an intuitive sense that might be the best way to respond to what's happening. And to also hold in the planetary conversations, to like take in the science, to take in the big discussions about climate refugees, to take in the big discussions about sea level rise, to really take that in too. I think it's important to not be too like in your privileged bubble to be able to put that big conversation away too. But I think that there's some connection to the planetary sized solutions being responded to with a planet full of local responses. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It does. And it makes me think about like this the cultural homecoming you mentioned there. That's just such a powerful idea. And is that an idea that I want to turn in the last few minutes we have together to be able to talk about this manuscript you're working on and some of the, you know, I don't want to reveal, you probably don't want to reveal too much.
It's all good.
Like, what are some of the broad themes and is this cultural homecoming, is that part of this work?
Yeah, I think it is, Justin. I think that, so in a elevator speech, this whole book that I've been wrestling with for the last 4 years that was part of my graduate thesis here at the U, which I got some incredible guidance from here at the University of Montana. This would not be in existence without this university. But essentially, it's a 7-part story about exploring the pan-cultural phenomenon of humans walking around areas, landscapes of significance.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this, you know, in every habitable continent, in most religious traditions, we find this practice of circumambulation.
Yeah, you used this fancy term before.
It's circumambulation,
like amble? Is
amble.
That the core word?
Yes, okay. Exactly. It's an annoying term. The Tibetans actually use the word kora, which is a much more succinct, beautiful term. So let's just use kora for now. Essentially, kind of became obsessed with this idea that humans would kind of circuitously walk around something important to them, and what that meant, what the significance of that was. And it took me on this crazy 4-year journey of travel to Mount Kailash in western Tibet
uh-huh.
with a bunch of spiritual kind of tourists. It was a really interesting story. And again, going back to our conversation about rhetoric and effective communication, that chapter is both about the power of this mountain that we end up in, but also the kind of quirky Western conceptions of how we got there, myself included. I am first to call my own kind of cultural blind spots out. Mm-hmm. But getting to this mountain, all that it took to get there, and this kind of amazing walk that happens, and the characters that I walked with. But essentially, it moves through landscapes, and it really kind of breaks down this idea that that circuitous motion is something that is ubiquitous in the natural world, like the seasonality, the cyclical nature of revolution, right?
Sure.
So the word revolution, which is described in a chapter,
yeah.
The word itself was born in the stars, the celestial revolving of planets, and it's really embedded that word etymologically in the natural world. And then it was kind of co-opted for human kind of revolt and human kind of transformation, political transformation, which is fascinating to me. And I try to kind of wed those two, of this ubiquity of revolution in the natural, and that revolution is kind of what guides us. The revolution is the kind of the frame or the shape of political, personal, and environmental transformation.
Yeah.
And so I explore that every chapter deeper and deeper through walking revolution, like walking, revolving around landscapes. And I do that in Tibet. I do that. I follow an old kind of beat poet trail in Northern California where in the 60s, I think Gary Snyder and Allen Ginsberg and Philip Whalen did this kind of really classic 14-mile loop around Mount Tamalpais.
Uh-huh.
And one of these chapters, I kind of re-walk that trail with a bunch of folks that have done it for years and kind of track their poetry and their sensibility of bringing that kind of Eastern philosophy to the Western world. And then, yeah, we get to Berkeley Pitt.
The Berkeley Pitt chapter,
and a few other chapters, too.
And so what's the... what's the timeline on this project?
Yeah, the timeline.
That's like the worst question you can ask an author, right?
It's good. No, I mean, this is my first stab at anything larger than a 10,000 word essay or something. So it's
it's a big project.
Totally poking in the dark here. There's some promising kind of doors opening. I would love to say in the next like 2 years, it might, or like a year, it might be a thing.
Yeah.
But that's just a public announcement so that I can get on my horse and make it happen. But again, going back to, you know, I get up every morning at 6 a.m. And look at this, stare at this thing. And I'm not like someone who's naturally gifted at writing. So I just have to, going back to like long distance running days, putting in 2 to 3 hours a day.
Yeah, gotta grind.
I want to look at that thing and just be with it. And I've been doing this for a long time.
Yeah.
And I care. This story means like the absolute world to me. And I really want to share it with people.
Well, so, let's hope a year from now that we're in this, well, maybe a different room, but maybe talking about this together in a way that's actively promoting a tangible book cover and something that people can actually go and consume.
Let's hope so.
And in the meantime, Nick, I mean, there's so much richness to your whole story that we didn't even get into. But I want to give listeners, as we close here, how can listeners who've been intrigued by this and want to learn more, how can they find out more about your work and where can they find you online?
Yeah, thanks, Justin. I'm just honored that you invited me to come on. I have a website, nicholastriolo.net, which seems to be kind of the repository for...
Sure, we'll put a link to that in the show notes for
show notes. Seems to be kind of a repository for publications and films and such. I'm actually currently the editor for Orion Magazine's online blog, so I'm doing a lot of really cool content, and they've really opened a lot of doors for me to meet some incredible storytellers in this vein of thought. So I'm on there publishing quite often, and I guess Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all those classic platforms.
Which they can find through your website.
Yeah, it's all probably that might be the best way to find it.
Well, Nick, thanks for stopping by on your way to Bend.
That's right.
To sort of launch on your next adventure, but I hope our paths cross again real soon.
Thanks, Justin. Appreciate it.
All right, fun conversation with Nick. I encourage you to check out his work. That guy is changing the world and using narrative and storytelling to do it. So check out his work. Okay, coming up next week, we got local rock star John Wicks drummer for Fitz and the Tantrums, and just all around awesome guy, mountain athlete, the owner and founder, co-founder with his wife Jenna of Drum Coffee, with two locations and now a roastery here in Montana or in Missoula. So awesome to sit down with John, and a connoisseur of used Eurovans as well. We talk about that in the beginning of the pod. So anyway, we'll see you next week. Remember that A New Angle was brought to you by CED, Consolidated Electrical Distributors. They're one of the largest electrical wholesale suppliers in the country with nearly 600 locations. CED is a privately owned business-to-business company that distributes just about every piece of equipment you need to keep your lights on, your energy flowing, and your lifestyle comfortable. CED is also an important employer in our community, and they have a keen interest in University of Montana graduates. To explore career opportunities, check out www.cedcareers.com. And if you enjoy this podcast, there are several ways you can support it. First, please rate us on iTunes. Ratings help others find the podcast. Second, write a review. The more reviews we get, and hopefully positive ones, the more we can grow. And third, please just tell your friends about it. As we wrap, I'd like to thank a few folks for making this podcast happen. First off, thanks to Elizabeth Willey, Communications Director at the University of Montana College of Business. And thanks to our fabulous interns, Savannah Sletton and Max Gibson. And I'd also like to give a special shout-out to VTO for providing us with music. And finally, thanks to my producer, Jeff Meese. As we go, if you have any questions, suggestions, comments, insults, whatever, please email me at anewangle@umontana.edu. Help us spread the word, and be sure to use the hashtag #anewangle when you do. Thanks a lot, and see you next time.